You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where writers and readers meet
and
story is everything. We're Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're delighted that you're joining us tonight, whether you're live with us on Facebook Live or you're listening to the audio stream or you're joining us 6 months from now. We are so delighted that you're here with us.
Who are we?
We
said that. Jim and Bobby Bell.
Oh, my goodness. The show opened with Hot Texas, performed by the Hot Texas Swing Band, and our great friend Alex Dormont makes that wonderful toe-tapping music available to us to open and close the show. And who is our guest tonight?
Our special guest tonight, Michael Roll.
And we're so happy to have Michael with us. Welcome,
right
Michael.
There.
I can see you in the camera. Hello, hello.
Happy to be here.
Glad to have you.
You have a little something?
We have a small bio.
About Michael. That sounds good.
My role crafts stories. As an award-winning filmmaker, as an author of more than a dozen nonfiction books about filmmaking, and through curated culinary experiences that reveal the unifying magic of breaking bread. He was one of the original designers of Apple's Emmy-winning software, Final Cut Pro, and he is the father of two young children.
And,
welcome, Michael.
And he's the author of the book we're going to talk about tonight, In Herschel's Wake. Yes, welcome, Michael.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
So, Mike, you please share a little bit about yourself and make an author.
You actually dropped out a tiny bit there. I didn't quite hear that.
Could you hear me?
No, it dropped out.
Oh, dear. Okay. That's all right. Can you?
I can hear you.
Okay. Could you, if you can hear me now, can you share a little bit about your background as a filmmaker and as an author?
Yeah. I mean, I've been doing projects that involve storytelling for most of my adult life. I've written a number of screenplays. I've produced a number of films and produced and directed. I also worked as an editor for a long time. And I really think that editing, in terms of the filmmaking world, the job of the editor is the most storytelling part of the job, because I'm not sure who quoted this, but there's a great quote that says, the director or the writer conceives the story, the director realizes the story, and the editor is the one that tells the story. They take all the bits and pieces and craft them and decide how long to hold on a particular moment, how to build suspense. And so I think I really learned storytelling from film editing. And I went to school for film a year or two ago in San Francisco in the late 80s, early 90s. And then got sucked into Silicon Valley, because that was the time that the first wave of technology startups and things were really booming, and developed this piece of software with some people. And that eventually got bought by Apple and became Final Cut Pro, which was an industry leading video editing software for many years. Mm-hmm. And then Apple ruined it and ruined the market. And hey, we don't have to talk about that part. But I left eventually. And meanwhile, all the while, I was doing my own film projects and writing other things. And I did a lot of technical writing, about a lot of filmmaking how-to books. And I wrote about 15 books about different aspects of filmmaking and editing and post-production and things. And But this is my first creative nonfiction. I mean, again, this isn't, you know, it's a memoir, but it's a much more creative book than the how to, you know, direct actors sort of thing. So I'm very excited about this one. And this came out in October from Boyle and Dalton Publishing. And it's been doing wonderfully. It's won a number of awards and accolades. It's just a real, it's been very, very exciting to be out and be able to talk about it like this.
Well, we thought it was a great book. You know, when I started reading it, I was kind of empathizing with you on the book, you know, and the trials and tribulations you went through, you know, because in some cases it's a little bit of a morbid subject. And then as we get farther into the book, I thought, you know, this thing is funny. I'm going to start laughing about this. So you could do that when you're not exactly involved in the story.
Well, I mean, it was actually honestly very important to me to make the book entertaining. And, you know, I mean, the title. So, I mean, the story for your viewers is, you know, my father was living on this remote Caribbean island on the lam from the law, hiding out on this island. And we had not been in touch. And I suddenly got the news that he had died. And I mean, we had been in infrequent touch and it was sudden, you know, he died suddenly. We didn't know. And I had to go to this little island with my two siblings, my sister and a half brother who I basically didn't know. I lost track of him when he was about 4 years old. His mom left my father and they went off. And so it was basically this brother I didn't know and my sister and I who were not estranged but weren't close at the time. Mm-hmm. And the three of us went down to this remote island to deal with this funeral. We didn't really know what to expect. And when we got there, we discovered that this island was much more remote than we could have realized. And there were no resources. And we had to do everything by hand and by ourselves. And so we had to build a coffin by hand. We had to dig a hole in the ground by hand. We had to clean and prepare the body by hand, all of this. And we were, and all while all of us had very troubled, complicated relationships with him and with mm-hmm. each other. And this is the experience that's told in the book, this going to this island and coming to terms with the complicated relationship I had with my father. And the new family that we built, that the three of us really sort of built, which still stands today. And so that, and it is, it's a light book. I mean, it's a book about a heavy subject, but it's a fairly, the tone is fairly humorous and light. And yeah, I really wanted it to be fun to read.
And it was. And I felt as a reader, at least in the stage of life that we're at, that you never know. Nobody ever knows, no matter how old you are, but you never know when you answer the phone or you open email, what kind of a message there's going to be like you received. And oftentimes unexpected, as it was for you. And suddenly there you are in the middle of the process. And so I felt that this book was very relatable. My dad wasn't like your dad, but so much of this book speaks to the humanness and decision-making and family relationships and what do you do, you know, and how would, are we prepared? It's kind of made me open that question up again, like, you know, your dad had a tremendous collection of books in his small space where he'd been living and you, and they had traveled, right? Those books had traveled with him.
They had moved from apartment to apartment as he moved from apartment to apartment. He was, you know, he lived a very chaotic and non-traditional life. He was very bohemian. He was a hippie, but all the, he sort of missed the 60s. He sort of spent the 60s very straight-laced and working as a pharmacologist. And then in the early 70s sort of dropped out and threw all that away and decided he had to be a novelist. He had to write this, and very important that he had to put his entire life into writing this book. But he never made money doing that. And so he really had to bounce around and find ways to survive in the meantime.
Well, and when I think about what you all went to do to get to that island, and I think about, well, he went there and all those books went with him. And we remember, we have not as many as he has, but I can know that when we loaded up a trailer to, you know, we were a moving van to come from LA to Albuquerque, we had a lot of books. That's a lot of weight.
Yeah, they're heavy, right?
Yeah.
You know, the only island, the only plane that goes to this island is like a 10-seater tiny plane.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, like this bookcase behind me, like imagine like, no joke, like 10 of these, maybe more, maybe 12 of these. That's, you know, fill all full of books. That's how many books we're talking about. Just thousands of books.
Yeah.
I don't know how they got there. I don't know how he managed to get them down there.
And then that was part of what you all had to decide, you know, as you're going through his things. It's like, what do we do with these? You know, it's part of the process that we have to go through when we're, you know, so it makes me, it's what it's done, Michael, for me, is I keep looking around and going, we got to let that go. We got to let that go. We got to.
I don't think we'll be moving, will we?
Moving's healthy. I used to like to move once a year, like in my 20s and even into my 30s. I was like, if you move once a year, it forces you to thin out your things and keep your life modest. I haven't followed that advice in the last 15 years or so. But
well, we also both felt, and you've already touched on this, that this is storytelling at its best. And one comment that I had written to remind myself is, I felt like you were, every word was a drop of your blood. And some of it had me laughing, and some of it had me very thinking, very pensive. And some of it had me going, is this fiction? Wait a minute. I got to go back and read. No, this is a memoir. but I always felt like all the different stories that you tell were like vignettes up on the big screen or small, whatever the screen, and that I was able to see and touch and hear and taste everything that you described. And that's storytelling at its best. And then when it stays with you, when you put the book down and you still want to have conversation, or you go back and read something aloud because you want to be sure you got it right, that's storytelling.
Well, thank you. I mean, that's terribly flattering to hear. I really appreciate that, because of course, you know, as a writer, that's my goal, and to try to communicate in that way and to help you get into that space. And you know, I've taught storytelling mostly around film, but more broadly just about the what is the nature of storytelling. And I've thought a lot about it, and I've tried to understand the mechanics of it for a long time to sort of deconstruct that so that one can recreate it consistently. And the truth is, over time I've gotten less confident with the structure, with the deconstruction that I've done, but there's a little bit of magic that's necessary. But you know, but there is also some craft, I think, that allows it to be consistent. And I think, you know, I learned creative writing through screenwriting, and screenwriting is an incredibly prescriptive format. There are a lot of rules. You have to do things very precisely. You have to include very specific things and not include other specific things. And it's all geared towards making the story come alive and feel really present for the reader. And so that a director can take that work and then, you know, turn it into a film. And so I'd like to think that I take some of that experience and bring that to this book. And hopefully it does have that visceral cinematic feel where while you're reading it, you really feel like you can, you're there, you know?
Well, it does, you know, because you tell the story as you move forward into what the final outcome is, the burying your father, you backtrack every once in a while and tell a story. And the story is like a scene or a play all of its own. And I noticed that after about two or three of these scenes, I thought, you know, this is kind of interesting how this is put together.
And that connects. Yeah, the past connecting to his present, moment.
I was going to say, this fellow was, you know, it's hard to, you know, he was sort of a Renaissance man, you know. I call him a kind of a jack of all trades. He was a
jackass of all trades.
We'll get to that now.
Okay, he said it, not us.
I got a cook, philosopher, a reader, a writer, a pot guru, a teacher, astrologist. Perhaps a pervert, and maybe a pain in the ass.
Certainly when he's your father, a lot of that, yeah.
It reminds me, of my dad. I said that the other night when we were talking. You know, I think one scene in there, I don't know if it's Paris, exactly what it was.
Oh, the scene in Paris. Across,
he was always walking ahead, always walking ahead. You know, I can relate to that. You cross the street or something, you just miss getting hit by a car. And I was a little kid, and it's night, and all of a sudden we're walking down the sidewalk. My dad decides he's going to cross the middle of the street, not even at a light. He goes over there, and I don't know what to do. And all of a sudden I'm following him, and I just miss getting hit by a bus. And lo and behold, he says, "Where were you? What are you doing?" And proceeds to give me a corrective right there on the sidewalk.
Right.
I was thinking, oh boy.
Fathers from different mothers. Yeah.
You know, that scene in the beginning kind of sets the story for this gentleman, your father. You know, you're having your bar mitzvah, and all of a sudden he shows up, and you haven't seen him for a while, and he gives you a gift. And and that scene, would you want to talk about it all? You know, just take a minute and talk about how, you know, because you create a real thing. It's not the gift he gives you, then he gets into the ceremony, I guess, into seating, trips over the chairs.
You know, it's funny because when I started the idea, when I was first inspired to write this story, it was very clear to me from the moment that I thought of it that that was the opening scene. Like, it just all came to me visually. You know, and it's also funny that I don't think I have a very good memory in life in general. I'm constantly I forget people's names. I forget what we did. I'm terrible. What did I do for my birthday last year?
Yeah.
I don't have a good memory, but when I started writing some of these scenes that Bar Mitzvah included, but lots of these memories, and the book is peppered with these flashback memories of childhood experiences with my father that sort of informed our relationship and explained sort of why I have such a complicated relationship. They're not all bad. Some of them are loving, beautiful.
That's right. They
and
are.
Some of them are really terrible where he did really unkind things. But while writing it, the memories would flood back, and like the details, tiny details, textures, sound, all of it would really, come back fully. And I was able to capture those things and put them into the scene. Talking about that scene in particular.
Would you want to?
Go ahead.
That's okay. We were just frozen for a moment. Please go ahead. Go ahead.
It's talking more about that scene. I mean, for your viewers and people listening to this, the gift he gave me was he gave me three joints for my, 13th birthday. In the synagogue, he hands me these joints, and that really happened. And in fact, I've been corresponding on Facebook with friends of mine, high school friends of mine who are reading the book now. And I've been writing back and forth with them when we were talking, and a couple of them were like, "Oh, I remember that. I smoked one of those joints,
That's great.
I think that scene does a good job of introducing him because he is, he's enigmatic. He's not, he is, it's exciting, especially for a 13-year-old to have an adult talk to them with that candor, and he was always candid, and he was always straight up, and he says in that, and I don't know if the dialogue is how close the dialogue is to what really happened, but he was like, "Religion's BS. Like, you don't need to buy into this. Like, you can choose to, but make sure you know what you're doing." And that was really inspiring and enlightening to me, and also, upsetting in the moment. I'm like, "Well, why are you telling me this now?"
Now.
Yeah. But and then he walks into the synagogue where everybody's waiting, and makes a big disturbance, and everybody gets everyone's attention, and then he, doesn't do anything to clean up his mess, and that's also him, making a mess wherever he goes and never thinking to bother doing anything to clean it up or help.
Yeah.
And that's a prologue of the book, and that sort of this memory of this bar mitzvah ends with me looking out at him and saying, God, please make him die. And then, you know, and then the next scene, the first chapter of the book is when I'm told that he's dead, when I get the news that he's dead.
Right. Do you want to read something aloud?
Sure. I've got a couple passages.
Yeah, let's hear it in your voice.
This is the first one I've got. This is the sex. This is when I'm flying. So to get to this little island where he lived, it's called St. Eustatius in the Netherlands Antilles. Mm-hmm. And it's an island of about 5,000 people. And this all happened in 2008, about 15 years ago. And so I had to take from Los Angeles, a flight to Miami, from Miami to Puerto Rico, from Puerto Rico to St. Martin, from St. Martin, finally to Statia, to the St. Eustatius. And this is about that very last flight to Statia. I boarded the plane last through the door at the rear. This was a seriously tiny plane, 5 rows with 1 seat on each side, except for the last row where there were 3 seats together. I spotted the 1 empty spot in the first row on the left behind the cockpit, which was separated from the cabin only by a tatty mauve curtain. I made my way up the aisle and sat down. Then I fished around for the seatbelt. I found 1 half, but the other side was missing the clasp. I looked around nervously and observed that no one seemed to have a seatbelt on. So I just sat there holding the unlatched belt in my hand. The pilot, a young local guy in his 20s with his uniform shirt unbuttoned a little too far, arrived and shut the passenger door from the outside. Then he went around and climbed into the cockpit through a separate door. He settled in quickly, revved the engines loudly, and the plane jerked into motion. No announcements, no illuminated seatbelt sign, nothing. After a short bit of high-speed taxiing, the pilot opened the throttle and we accelerated quickly. In a moment, we were off into the air, wobbly accelerating through the thermals rising over the warm Caribbean. I grabbed the seat firmly with both hands and looked out the window as we soared up over the crystal blue water. We banked hard to the left, and I watched the tiny strip of beach on St. Martin disappear below us. I closed my eyes and fought to keep my stomach below my throat. The pilot swiveled around in his chair and yelled to us over the considerable noise of the plane. We get some weather now. No worries. Just a little bumpy. We'd be safe on the ground in 15 minutes. He seemed to recognize the woman sitting behind me and he winked at her with a smile. Almost immediately, the plane began quivering and jerking in an unnatural horizontal motion. I looked out the window to the endless blue of the ocean and the continuous hue of the sky, and I searched for the line where they met out at the distant horizon. A few thunderheads were visible ahead of us. I wondered how close we were to the Bermuda Triangle. Still, despite the bumpiness, a strange calm overtook me. If this little plane with its broken seatbelts and distracted pilot did me in, no one could fault me. At that moment, I wasn't living on my own behalf. I was taking care of a duty so much older and bigger than me. I was honoring my father, honoring an ancient tradition, older than God, as one as old as humankind itself. No matter what happened, I felt clean, justified, worthy. Just then we hit an air pocket and seemed to fall 100 feet in an instant. I blurted out aloud, "Whoa!" with all the gusto of the Caribbean women on my flight from Puerto Rico. The rest of the passengers remained silent. I smiled to myself. Maybe it was all going to be okay. And in a few minutes, we swooped down hard, banked left and then right, and I saw we were heading directly toward a volcano sticking out of the ocean, St. Eustatius. The pilot maneuvered deftly and cut the engines to a quiet hum a moment before we gently touched down on the tiny runway. Once we were on the ground, he turned around to the cabin and smiled and winked again at that one woman sitting behind me. "We at Statia now," he said. "May you all have a meaningful stay."
That's great.
Thank you. We've just been listening to Michael read aloud from this really, really wonderful book, In Herschel's Wake. And the book is just filled with exactly that kind of storytelling.
Michael,
we're going to take a very short break so that our listeners can find out how they can buy the book. Correct. We're going to hear about Out West Shop's affiliate bookshop page, and we'll be right back. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story. And we're back with our special guest, Michael Wolff. So fun to have him with us. I wish we were right in the same room across the table. I think we'd be, that would be so much fun. So, but here we are. Was it difficult to write things about your sister and your brother and your mother? And did you wonder how would they respond in the writing of this is a memoir after all, right?
Yeah, it's challenging. And I mean, it's still challenging. I think the writing process feels a bit trance-like. And so in the process of getting the first draft out, I am able to sort of get out of my way. I guess when it's working, I can get out of my way and it just sort of comes out and I'm not thinking too much about who's judging it or who's reading it, whatever. But you know, then it comes time to share it. And I shared it with all those people, with my sister, my brother, my mother. My mother isn't really in the book a lot, but there's a little bit about her. And my sister and brother are very much in the book. And I shared it with them a long time ago. In fact, so I wrote the first draft of the book quite a long time ago, about 6 years, 7 years ago. Yeah. And then put it down and started focusing on the screenplay. Because I really wanted to make a movie version of it, and hopefully it still will. But when I finished the first book, I shared it with all of them, and all of them read it, and you know, and had feedback and responses. And I mean, and honestly, everyone was very generous with their feedback. I mean, there are some critical things. You know, my sister in particular, I paint her fairly critically at the beginning of the book, although. Part of that is intended to be, there's a little bit of a dramatic arc where the character myself, but the character in the story is mad at her and is frustrated with her. And I express that. And then by the end, sort of find the tremendous love and appreciation for her and the connection that was lacking in the beginning. And so I was a little worried that, you know, she would focus on the negative part of that and not see the whole story of that. But she was really beautiful about it and was really responsive. And honestly, like, they also, all those people and all my other close friends, my wife and other friends have read that, met so many versions, that original first draft of the book and then the screenplay version and then the revisions of the screenplay and then the revision of the book, which is now what you're looking at. So they've read the various versions. And, you know, my sister at some point with the screenplay was like, don't pull your punches with me. Like, I can take it. Like, you can make the character more of a jerk so that the story works better. And I, you know, and of course, my sister is also my father's child and has the same reverence for story that I have, that I think is something he imbibed in, you know, imbued in us.
I wondered through some of the stories, I thought, I would like to hear this from her point of view, because you talk about some things you did together as youngsters. There was a kind of a shop, a dark, dingy shop that sort of had her, yes, thank you. And you two went together through that space, I think, if I recall correctly. And she was quite interested in what was there, as you were. And I thought, you know, she had a relationship with your dad too. And I wondered how multiple point of view on some of these would be interesting. You know, like if you were sitting around the table together and you were sharing that, and what would she say about that story? What would her memory be?
I mean, I that would be amazing. I mean, I don't know if you've read Fleischman in Trouble, which is a book that came out a few years ago and now was just made into a TV show this year. But it does an incredible job of turning the tables. The story is told from one person's perspective, and it's about a divorce. And it's really like it's told from the man's perspective, and he really paints the wife terribly. And, you know, you're reading it, you believe this perspective. And then at the very end, it shifts and shows her side of the story. And it's not like, I mean, it's not that they were both terrible, but they're, you see the same events in such a different light, mm-hmm. and it adds such a layer, and it's more complex than a he said, she said. It's more like a mm-hmm. real Rashomon, like mm-hmm. where you really see the world and you realize everyone has their own view. Mm-hmm. Everyone has their own perspective, and there's no right